Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Guys, lean in. Big news. It's big news, lean in. It's a new series of the Create More podcast with me, Ben Stewart. Yay! And on this fortnight's podcast, we have Wooden Overcoats. If you've not heard of that before, they are a fantastic comedy podcast. And I sit down with Andy Goddard and John Wakefield, who are the writer-directors of a brilliant comedy podcast. In fact, I'm going to do something totally out of the ordinary for a podcast. I'm going to tell you to stop listening to this one. Go on iTunes or Acast or anywhere else that you want to find it and listen to at least the first episode of Wooden Overcoats, and that will probably lead on to a few more. But one, you should just definitely listen to it. But two, we have a really long in-depth chat all about how it was made, what they do, all about the writer, David K. Barnes, and I think it would help you a lot to listen to it. So you should definitely stop and listen to it. You've done that? Good. So we sit down for an hour. We actually go over to I've got to give a bit of a shout out to the Art Space Studio in Brixton, which is where the whole podcast sitcom was recorded. No, hang on, let me take it back a notch. What is Wooden Overcoats? It is a podcast sitcom based on a fictionary island about two competing funeral homes. It's a comedy. Go with me. They describe it a lot better on my podcast, but it's brilliant. And they are two really funny, genuinely lovely, down-to-earth people, and they gave a massive amount of their time to sit down with me. And we went to the Art Space Studio in Brixton. And I wanted to go there, see how they recorded it. See, you know, I've never been to a proper recording studio before. So I turn up and there's a yoga class going on, you know, which is fine to watch for a bit. And then suddenly, you know, John and Andy turn up and get taken to the back, like through this like dodgy looking kitchen. And then in the back, there's this fantastic recording studio. So we sat down, and again, another special mention to Tom Gillian. I probably pronounced that wrong, but he is the kind of studio engineer for the podcast, for the Wooden Overcoats podcast. And it was great. I just got to sit down and I didn't have to do anything. He set up all the microphones. We're in a professional recording studio with professional microphones. It was amazing. I just had to sit there and just talk, which pretty much is what I'm doing in my room right now. But it was brilliant. So yeah, listen to the podcast. And you all know everything about, well, one, what does a writer-director do for a podcast? What does a producer do? What is an actual director's role on a non-visual medium? And also, Andy and John are just, they're lovely. So listen to the podcast. But this is a new 10-part series. So I've got loads of people to interview now. I've actually got quite a few people lined up already. We've got one of the creative directors at a virtual reality company or department from a company called Unit 9. He's Rillian Simon. And we're going to go all about the future of VR. And I think 2016 is going to be the future of VR. And then I've still got Kidway from Factory 15. He does that animation. And they're kind of, I guess, think of them as like a mini Pixar. And they do amazing stuff. And then someone else I've met before Christmas is Jonathan Steiner, who's the founder of OpenDesk. That might ring a bell with WikiHouse and Alistair Parvin, who someone interviewed for the last series. I'm also doing a Kickstarter special. I won't go that into too much, but that's two cool guys I work with at Make, and we're going to sit down and have a good chat about how the hell you do a Kickstarter, why they're cool. I've also got, I'm doing a foreign New York podcast. I'm not going to New York. We're going to Skype and record it in a technically clever way. But he is another podcaster who does these fantastic, it's called Between the Liner Notes. That's Between the Liner Notes. And it's a music-based kind of documentary one. And they're kind of, if you listen to 99 PI, 99% Invisible. It's that kind of, oh, I never thought that would be interesting. And you just kind of get sucked into these 20-minute stories and they're great. So I'm going to talk to Olive at him. He's got a successful podcast all about what it's like. And I'm going to try and attempt over Skype. So there's loads of stuff to look forward to. So something I do always have to say at this point, subscribe. It would be amazing if you subscribe, because we have a few hundred people who subscribe now, and it makes a real difference. Every time I release a podcast, it just goes straight into your iTunes or your whoever you subscribe with, and it makes a real difference. But I'm going to stop talking and listen to the end for a bit of background gossip. But I really hope you enjoy the new series. There'll be one coming out every 2 weeks. This is coming out on Wednesday, and then every 2 weeks after that. I mean, I will be having a child during that time, a boy, if you're asking. So I have no idea what future podcasts will be like, how much energy I have. I might sound completely miserable or elated. I have no idea. But yeah, thank you so much for listening, and I really hope you enjoy the podcast. Enjoy. Bye. The reason I'm paranoid, I recorded another podcast and I realized after 5 minutes I hadn't only recorded her voice, not mine, and I was like,
oh, there were worse things to happen. That's
I was like, I'm so sorry. Anyway, well, I'm gonna start now. So I'm with Andy Goddard.
Hi.
And John, I forgot his name.
Wakefield,
there you go. And I'm going to go off your website. Your website describes you as directors and producer extraordinaires of Wooden Overcoats.
Well, make it clear, we didn't write write that description.
You didn't?
Well, our fictional PR... I can't say that out loud. That was all written up by probably Felix.
No, David wrote everything for the website.
David.
We've been such a good team that our writer actually wrote a lot of the stuff for the website as well, I think.
I'm going to get my notes out. I'm not playing my phone. The writer's David...
David K. Barnes.
I didn't get my notes that quick. David K. Barnes. Because also on the website, Tom doesn't come off particularly well on the website. He's one of the comments on the website is he disappears back into obscurity.
But
that's obviously written by David, said.
I think that's deeply unfair.
It's been a lovely running joke with Tom, because after the show we've been doing a lot of live shows as well. That Tom and David have been helming between them.
Yeah. Okay.
And Tom comes on and introduces David in a very self-aggrandizing way. And then David comes off and gives everyone a wonderful introduction. And then lets Tom come back onto the stage and the show starts.
For the last one, to make up for it, he did a list of adjectives that went on for, I think, a good 2 minutes. Where he was just going, the wonderful, the mellifluous, the extravagant, the terrifying, that and... I think it was more boring.
So this is the live shows you do as well. Okay, yeah. So why don't we start with, for people who don't know what Wooden Overcoats is, who wants to describe what? Because it's, if as a one-liner, for people who haven't listened to it, it's a great sell.
It's a show about two rival funeral directors on an island that's only a mile long.
Okay.
So, I mean, the first question that everyone always goes is like, well, so are enough people dying? And then I go, listen to the series. So essentially one of the funeral directors is a guy called Rudyard Funn, who's been there for years. It's a family business going back to what's canon, is it 15th century?
Yeah, the 16th 15th century,
something like that, a long time ago. And he's quite kind of taciturn and difficult, and not necessarily the best funeral director. Most of his funerals tend to end in mindless violence. And then one day Eric Chapman arrives on the island, and his life is turned upside down when a guy who is essentially the Google of funeral directors comes and shocks everyone by the fact that funerals can actually be quite nice affairs. Most of his turn into parties.
He's putting the fun in funerals.
Yeah. And that's essentially the setup for the series. I mean, there's lots of other side characters. Well, lots of other main characters, actually. So living with Rudyard, we have Georgie and Antigone, who are... played respectively by Keira Baxendale and Beth Eyre. Fantastic actors. And Antigone is Rudyard Funn's twin sister, who, due to in utero depression, was born a week later. And Georgie is their sort of plucky assistant who seems to have been magicked out of the air by the northern gods.
I think we'll find out what happens to Georgie at some point in the future, hopefully. But yeah. As it stands, haven't got a clue where she's from. Well, when no, she's turned
I think we discussed early on that...
I love that you never actually mention anything about George's backstory.
I mean, we have got a backstory that's sort of there, but I don't know if we want to say anything in case something may turn up in...
Well,
in the future.
Like, David hasn't confirmed it with us, but I reckon, and so this is not canon, I reckon Georgie and her nan both sort of washed up on Piffling by accident. and because her nan was there, Georgie didn't really want to leave again, sort of wanted to look after her and like, went looking for a job. And then, like, the first shop she stumbled into was Fun Funerals. And then, like, she asked for a job. Rudyard said no, and then she just stayed.
I've just realised I really want to see an offshoot series. This will mean nothing for anyone who's not heard it. But with Georgie in San Marino.
just having a lonely holiday.
Yeah. So I guess, because the nice thing was that I was... One of you guys or someone tweeted me about coming on the podcast. Or,
Yeah.
And so I went and listened to it and loved the podcast. It's been great. Like knowing I was going to get you guys on the podcast, but it would be at the end of the series as like a roundup, and being able to like look back on it. It's been great. So I've been telling everyone I know that they should listen to it, and they go, "What's it about?" And then I give them the sell, and they're like. And it's good, is it? I'm like, no, it's really good. You should listen to it. It's really funny. But I guess, like, so to kind of outline what I want to talk about, I think I want to go more about what you guys do, because, again, this is part of the podcast I want to know more. And then also, why a podcast? Why not, you know, why not through some of the bigger, more established channels, I guess? So if we start with what are your guys' roles as, because you're producers and directors.
Mm-hmm.
So David writes it.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the beginning. How did this start?
There's an element of input from us there. I mean, I don't want to take away any sort of efficacy from David because he is a
genius,
masterminded the story arcs for the series, like all the kind of character development. We had a few guest writers, I'll just name drop them quickly, in the form of Tom Crowley, who plays Eric, and then we had Cordelia Lynn, who's a Royal Court writer, and then we had Tiff Woodsmith, who's a wonderful writer, who's a friend of David's,
and Chris Hock.
Who has written a Korean zombie musical.
Korean zombie
musical.
Nice.
I believe. He's probably going to...
What perfect training for
perfect. And what they all said about David was like, you know, you'd send his scripts in and he sort of like converts it into a wooden overcoat script. Like just like within a couple of tiny like edits and it just suddenly a different thing. But anyway, so... David, Felix, and Tom kind of came to us with a pitch for the show, and they were like, "Do you want to be involved?" And like, obviously, we were like, "Yes, we'll make that thing, please."
Yeah.
And so John and I's input early on was mostly just sort of going, "How about we take it kind of in this direction?"
Yeah, we were shaping what we thought the show would end up being. So, you know, the fact we ended up recording it in studio, the fact that it had the sound quality that we ended up, we said to David, can we do stupid things because we want to make stupid sounds,
but
I think keep it within a sort of very realistic setting. So David would come and talk to us and go, "Does this work? What do you think of this story arc?" And essentially, we were a sounding board where we talk about things and help shape the scripts, and then they will go
when was this? This was last year, was it?
Would be early this year.
Okay, fair enough.
It started back in January
as a very like early idea, and then there's a very short page long, not a synopsis, but like this is an outline of the whole series, episode?
It sort of didn't work how you'd normally pitch it, because essentially David lives with Felix, the lead actor. And the story they tell about it is
who plays Rudyard?
Who plays Rudyard? Yeah, yeah.
Amazing, yeah. My favourite character.
Really?
He'll be chuffed with that.
Yeah, he'll be really happy with that. Well, nearly everyone says Antigone, but anyway. So the story they tell is him and Tom met on a bridge one day and said,
and then Mark Rylance turned up with Tom Hanks and all kicked off.
Being silent and strong, and Tom Hanks being sort of laddie in America. They met up on a bridge one day and said, "Oh, how about we do a short film about two rival undertakers?" And then they went, "Oh, that sounds like a great idea."
And then Spike Milligan and Marty Feldman had already done it.
That had happened. And they sort of ended up just not really doing anything about it. And then they mentioned it to David, who was in his pants at the time, who then sprinted upstairs and half an hour later came down with a pilot script and a synopsis for the series. Which is what we ended up with. So that was sort of the basis for it. And then after that, it was kind of just show shaping and stuff. I mean, back in the beginning of it, we were going to be making it with a production company who will remain nameless. And so they were trying to push us in all sorts of, gently push us in different ways with it.
Can I ask, the nameless production company, when you say push you in different ways, I guess the nice thing about Wooden Overcoat is it genuinely feels like it was whatever worked as an idea. It doesn't feel in any way shaped for, I don't know, mainstream. Not that I'm saying it's not.
No.
If you catch my drift. But how would a production company shape it in a way that wasn't what it's turned out to be?
They wanted to do it live.
Yeah, they wanted it to be a live show which obviously we ended up doing, but the shows we did live were very different than the ones that went out on the podcast, which I think would have changed the mood of it completely, because I don't think you would have bought the world anywhere near as much as you bought the world doing it in studio. I don't think it would have stood out.
Yeah.
It would have been the sort of thing that, if you listen to Radio 4, and Radio 4 makes some incredible stuff, and they make some incredible stuff with that studio audience format, but it just wasn't what we really wanted to do. We wouldn't ever have been able to do it, I don't think, as well. Or it's especially on our own, if we were to do that.
Yeah, live recording comes with all sorts of issues. The way we did it here in the sort of music studio environment, it's such, the audio comes out so crisp and malleable that you can put it anywhere and you can make it feel almost like you've gone in with a doc mic to somewhere in Piffling. If you work hard enough, we didn't work hard enough really after the first episode to do that, but but you can. So to do it in that live context, I think, would have been a little bit of a betrayal of the of the world that David had built through the scripts. We've rambled for ages. Has there been a question? Or just...
So I'm asking you about how it started, about the very original idea and how a production company, how they would change it. And you were saying they would go to live studio things. But that's another thing I didn't know you guys did a live performance until only about a month ago, and I was like, oh, I think they've all, I missed them.
Oh man, we should have told you.
Yeah, it's a shame. They were fun, but they were there for two reasons, really. Because one, we suddenly found we had a fan base, which was such a thrilling thing to find out. Because
ridiculous.
When we're basically sitting in small rooms at a laptop, putting 4 days' work here together over a number of weeks, you sort of forget that. I think, what are we up to now? 25,000 downloads of the podcast.
Yeah, it is 25,000.
Amazing,
Which, considering there are only eight, we are so thrilled and so grateful to everyone who has listened. But it meant we could do two things. One, we could bring it back to the people who heard it and actually do some sort of live thing for them. And two, because we weren't associated with any production company, we didn't have a budget. It enabled us to, through kind donations by people who wanted to come to those shows, make the money back that we'd spent on getting the show together. And it also did a great thing for us as a team, because when we did this here, say 4 days, we recorded eight episodes, which is how many hours of 4 hours, over 4 hours.
Last two are 35, so 4 hours 10 total.
Yeah. And
that's what you're getting for free. 4 hours, 10 awesome comedy.
Yeah, dropping that.
and so obviously we were working at least 12-hour days on it.
Yeah.
I was going to say, when you said 4 days, that's all it took to record. That seems like quite a huge amount of recording.
We were at 8:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
And we were out about 7.
Yeah, that doesn't include us getting up at 6 in the morning to go over the scripts before we got here, to block them again, to make sure we knew exactly what was going on.
And then, coming home and going sometimes listening to the rushes. Sometimes we just went, no, it's pub time. Which is still work.
But what it meant is, we had these incredible comedy performers. I mean, I'm still astonished when you look down the list of the people who so brilliantly came in and just did their bit. And you know, sometimes we would get to go, hi, you know, so nice to meet you. Thank you so much for doing this. You know, it's been lovely talking to you over email, but thank you for coming down. Right, you're this person. There's the studio. Script? Yeah, cool. Record. Great, that was fab. Could you do it this way? Fab. Oh, it's been so nice having you here. We've got to do the next scene. And you just miss these people. And
yeah, all the actors talked to them loads.
Yeah, because
but we would like work in solid all the way through the day. Like our lunch break was probably about 20 minutes, and we'd just like grab a slice of pizza,
run back
down
in
a coffee, and then sprint back in again.
But what the live shows meant was, what was so fab was they all enjoyed working on the project so much, and we, you know, most of these people they'd signed on to do a day or at most 4 days.
Some of them were just like for an hour.
Yeah, and pretty much everyone in the cast said they'd come back and give their time again.
That's amazing, isn't it?
For the live show.
It's really touching, to be honest.
Yeah, I definitely think that comes across in the whole podcast. I think that's why, I guess, just going back to me listening to it, first episode, second episode, I loved, and it was like, I was like, well, I'm just going to, I want to keep listening to them because they're such a nice thing to, especially on my tube journey. They're almost the exact length of a tube journey.
Yes,
that was intentional.
Yeah, is that intentional? That was like, do we do 15 minutes? Do we do an hour? Like,
so there's two rationales for it being half an hour. One is we wanted to sort of bring a kind of broadcast discipline to podcast, which very much does involve going, this is your tight format. This is like, it is this long, so you can always expect it to be this long. And so you always like, you know, there's a familiarity factor there that's important. And the other one was literally like, I reckon most people, when they jump on the tube to get one place or other, they probably live about half an hour away from where they work.
Yeah.
And so you want to kind of catch that audience who are really important to us, who are your commuters and things, who are just looking for something to do.
Yeah.
And if their something to do is like entering Piffling for a
God, that's go to this mental island.
Entering what is Piffling.
That? Yeah, more power to you.
Not Lewis Carroll.
Yeah. But I've had those moments where, because I always listen to music, never listen to comedy. So the first time when I'm on the tube and I'm just sat down with opposite someone and I've just burst out laughing, it's the eeriest thing to have someone do that, and you're like trying to not catch people's eye. You look like such an idiot on the tube, but I'll take that hit.
I like to think whenever there's someone looking like they're madly laughing to themselves, that they are in fact listening to Wooden Overcast.
I've always listened to comedy on the go. I mean, it's always been the one thing I will listen to on my commutes and everything. But I've always had that feeling of, no, you mustn't show that you're like laughing manically to yourself. And I remember I was walking somewhere once and trying to keep that stony face. And the worst thing that could possibly happen, this sort of elderly woman was tottering the other way and just looked at me and went, don't worry, dear, it'll never happen. I'm having a great time.
Don't judge me, I'm listening to comedy. But I think as well, the nice thing is that, because I've listened to all of them, by the eighth episode, you've been with those characters for so long that I made my wife listen to one. She's like, I don't get what's going on. And I was literally howling with laughter because you get to know all their little... This is why I like Rodyard so much. He's like, I just think he's brilliant. Mm. And I didn't... I guess the actor would have been a lot older when I saw a picture of Felix. Yeah, I was like,
Again, the brilliant thing about radio.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But you were saying... we'll kind of come back to the live stuff in a bit, but one of the things I was interested in, the way you record it, you did it all in this studio, which is, where's this? This is on Brixton Road, no.
Brixton Hill.
Yep. Brixton Hill, yeah. And it's like a, did you hire it just for 4 days? You have to pay per day to hire this whole space out?
Yes. We got a nice deal on it.
Yeah. And Tom is an incredible engineer. Shout out to Tom who set up this setup today.
Yeah, Thank you very much, Tom.
This is why it sounds so lovely.
Yeah.
Can you actually hear us?
we did it in here mostly because it was cheaper than going elsewhere, but it's kind of worked out really nicely for us because it has its own sort of unique sonic stamp. I'm going to come out with all these horrible...
I mean, that's terrible.
Dude, we can nerd out about podcasts and audio, all you want.
unique comics.
Sonic stamp.
Unique Sonic.
The simulants in there, man.
You should have just said USS and then be...
It has its own USS, yeah. As we talk, every day in marketing.
And then I'll look blank and then audio people go, very good.
Yeah,
it's not a thing. Yeah. It's not a thing.
It's a thing. Oh God, what was the question?
This studio space. Why is it so good? Relax.
Why is it so good?
Yeah.
So... we essentially converted the... There's like a massive drum room here. There's like a big sort of hexagonal... Is it hexagonal or... It doesn't matter.
Octagonal.
Octagonal.
That's why it's the octagon.
That's another three walls. and yeah, we converted that into three separate spaces. So we had basically a set for fun funerals, which was a lot of kind of wood and glass. That's why it sounds so kind of reverb. Oh, what's the word?
Reverby? Wooden.
Reverbery.
Reverbery.
Sounds like reverbery.
We're all audio experts in here.
What was so wonderful walking in here, because, you know, this place is a hidden gem. You get to that front, there's a yoga studio.
Which was great to walk into this morning, I should just add.
You come in, do your ablutions, then you make some radio comedy.
What have I come to? What is this place? Yeah. And then you go down this long corridor, and then there's a door, and then there's a kitchen. You think, there's a studio here? Yeah. And then you go through this next door, and you're suddenly into this maze of really lovely little studio rooms with incredible staff and incredible equipment, all brilliantly curated by Tom Nolte. And I walked in here for the first time, and Tom showed me the Octagon Room. And I looked at the floor, and it's got a stone floor. And I thought, this is a funeral parlour. And, you know, we don't need to fake people stomping about on a stone floor. We can just remove these beautiful rugs they've got to dampen the sound. And we have our set. And to be able to just put a microphone in a corner of that, and so what was our setup for fun? It was the three walls, the table, the 1950s Bakelite telephone that is there. So whenever that happens, that is them answering
That's
the phone.
Perfect, isn't it?
And then you put your stereo setup in the middle, and then it just captures that sort of ambience. Like the Fun Funerals things has no plugins or anything on it at all. There's a bit of light EQing to make it not sound as. Because the problem is when you set all that up, it can sound a little bit ugly because it's so woody.
Yeah.
But apart from that, it's pretty much clean. I didn't put any reverbs on.
No, I haven't. I'm glad we decided that now. Essentially, we managed to turn this space into what the BBC sort of uses in their big broadcasting spaces. So we used different spaces in there for different sets. We had pretty much two permanent sets, which were a nice small room, which had a sort of sofa in it and some carpets and things, which became places like Chapman's and the mayor's office and things like that. Then we had the fun funeral set, which never really changed. And then we had a sort of larger open space, which was used for all big halls and things like that.
And the mortuary.
And then if you come down the corridor, the only place we have sight lines from the booth we're recording this in is a dead room, which is, if you go in there and shout, it's, you know, wall to ceiling in soundproof foam.
Baffles.
That's the one. You wouldn't know a word in a studio, would you?
I love baffles.
And so we did all our dead stuff in there. So
what do you mean when you say dead noise?
So dead sound is when there's very, very little reverb. So the person's voice is the person's voice and there's no room around it, which is quite hard to capture even in a small space like that because naturally a room, sound waves like to come back. But for when we're doing all our big outside scenes and all our funeral scenes, we gather people around a microphone in there and then we can play about with that completely dead sound and make it sound
so that you can tweak it however you want it. Then there's a lot more freedom afterwards. Okay, fair enough.
We'll take a picture of that or give you a picture of the room in there. It's tiny, and so like some of those massive outdoor scenes were an absolute nightmare to do in there. Like it was not great fun, but it just got really, really hot.
In the middle of summer. We nearly killed one of our actors.
Bless Steve Hodson,
who's the mayor
in it. We had like him.
He's brilliant as the mayor, isn't he? Do you know, every time you mention a character, I'm like, love that character.
Yeah, it's going well.
Oh, God, what's that line he does? The one that...
He'll come back to you.
He'll come back to me. I sort of developed an impression of one of his lines. It's so hard to imitate. His vocal cords are going everywhere all the time. We had about sort of 9 or 10 people in there for that cliff chase scene. So they had like three people as extras. They had all the main characters sort of shouting over each other and like people wandering in and wandering out and sort of having to kind of creep around mic stands and things just to like make sure they didn't knock the audio.
Yeah, we'll find a picture of this. It really is people really having to sort of punching their way around. And it gets even more complicated when you've got, you know, that room is about half the size of the room we're in now, so it's tiny.
Oh, it's that small. Oh, okay, fair enough.
That small. And for the not just the big scenes where there are a lot of people, which are almost in one way okay, it's then the scenes like, say, in episode 6, where for those who haven't heard it, a lot of it ends up out at sea.
Mm.
Not to ruin anything, but you get people calling from other boats and things like that. And when in reality, you know, your main character is sitting in a lifeboat here, and then Eric's only actually probably about here pretending to be on another boat. When we get that audio, it's you then have to suddenly go, oh, he's miles away, you know, and really pull that back and have people being thrown into the ocean. And that space allows you to do that, but it's also, and the trick is making that space believable in the world you're creating.
There were, like, because we did this in 4 days and sort of basically guessed what we'd need for the edit for a lot of bits, there were quite a few times when it came round to finishing off episodes where, like, you know, and you just sort of slap your whole head against the desk and just go, oh, God. What I did there seemed really clever, and now this is going to take about 6 hours to fix that one sentence. I was going to go somewhere with that. I just said something really negative.
But what I was going to say is I've been lucky enough to walk around the drama studios that the BBC have, both in Broadcasting House and in Salford at Media City. And what they have are these extraordinary spaces that can sort of be converted to almost anything.
Mm.
So they the one in Broadcasting House, they have a wide open space with lots of doors just in the wall. So if you open a door, you know, for anywhere, it can be a door for anywhere. They have steps going up to a second level. The steps are divided into two. One might be a metal gangway, one might be a wooden stairs.
So you've got like a whole room of different type of atmospheres and noises and shapes and things. And
exactly.
Just to get the temperature of the sound.
And the first part there, my favourite one, is they have a small room that overlooks the main space, which they can open a window and they can play effects into the main space like a cityscape. So if they're recording in this room, say it's a New York hotel room, and you've got your spies chatting in the foreground and they go, oh, I need some fresh air, and they open the window, the sound will flood in as though you're in New York. And
that's really good, isn't it?
You know, so you're not faking it. And we essentially sat down in here and, with the help of Tom, created a miniature version of that.
We don't have anything that funky. So, like, any time a door opens and something comes in from the outside, that is us, and that took ages.
The number of times our flat appears in this project.
Oh, yeah. My bedroom door is overused.
So do you... Because for those recordings, do you have, like a professional little, like, portable mic? You're like, oh, do you know what? That clicky noise that our light switch makes, that'd be perfect, right?
And like, big shout-out to Zoom.
Everyone should have one.
Great mics. So we both have a Zoom stereo recorder. And, like... Yeah, literally, if I needed a sound effect, I probably wouldn't look further than 20 metres from my house because I'm a lazy radio host. And so, like, all of those sort of bin sound effects and things are the bins outside the back. And, like, that part where a fox gets strung up from a tree, that was real.
Yeah. That was in the news.
Yeah, in the news. And the bit where the cat gets, yeah, I've gone off on them.
Do you know what? Again, it's fine to go off on one. That's the brilliant thing about this podcast, is the best parts are the bits where we go off on one. So don't worry about that at all. Because I came in with a load of questions, and then being in this room, I should describe that normally my setup is a laptop with a tiny little mic, two microphones, and just any room I can get available. You've now upgraded me to a full functioning recording studio with wonderful Tom, who set up three mics, and I have this super professional audio thing, and like every question that I had seems very small now, and I want to ask you a million more. So
sure,
apologies if I go off on a random tangent, but that's because you keep mentioning stuff that I don't know and I don't understand. So part of the appeal and the reason that people listen to it is like almost other jobs that people just weren't aware of. And when I asked you, kind of, when you say producers, when I always think of movies, a movie producer, and I didn't really know what that is, and that's more about money. Whereas you're producer directors, and it sounds, when I first read it, I wasn't aware of what you did, but now we've spoken before and now, I guess you guys run the show completely, and like David writes it and there's other writers, but you're the kind of captains of the ship, essentially.
Yeah. That's sort of how radio has always worked, I suppose, because it's the thing that's always attracted me about radio. is if you're going into film, you're going to need your director, you're going to need your producer. You possibly could combine them, but it'd be a lot of work. But you're going to need your DOP, you're going to need your cameraman, you're going to need your sound recordist. With radio, it's you and an engineer. Your writer gives you the script. And it's your vision.
Yeah,
not to say that, obviously, you pull more people in on that because more people's ideas are better than one person's head. But you do get that amazing directness. And you just don't need the more people. Mm. So often in the history of radio, you will hear in radio drama, it was produced by such and such. And that means they directed it. They organised it. They brought it all together.
Mm. It's a bit of an auteur's craft, radio in general. That's one of the ones.
Put a microphone in front of you and you suddenly become.
Yeah, yeah, just start saying things.
I love watching your eyes roll. You're like, I've done it again.
Don't even know what I said. What does it even mean?
I mean, auteurs need that USS, Andy.
Yeah. Every auteur has a USS. But there's a long tradition of that, especially in like American radio drama and stuff, where you've got all these like mad eccentrics.
Who let Orson Welles loose with a microphone?
Yeah, who let Orson Welles? It's a nutter. Like, brilliant, but nutter. And so you get these guys who, what's his name? Is it Corwin? The guy who did the folk cantatas and stuff. Tim Crook is going to slap us both in the face when we get.
No, I was thinking about them this morning.
Corwin.
You come back to it.
I think we're both getting distracted by the fact that it sounds like Corbyn, but it's nothing to do with it.
It'll come back.
So there's this this guy who, for the sake of argument, is called Corbyn.
Okay, yeah.
And he, just watching John in the corner of my eye, it's like distressed about this. I'm so sure it is. And so he would write these like epic kind of musical ballads, and he'd have to do them live on NPR, and so they NBC even.
They
were Paramount, weren't they? No?
Well, the really famous radio...
What?
Which, who are you talking about?
I'm talking about American Black.
Are you talking about American Black? Oh, I'm completely wrong then.
Corwin.
I think you're good. Corwin. Yeah. I've never heard of the guy.
Carry on.
And it was either for Paramount or it could be many other... and so he'd end up with like a whole sort of live band, and he'd written the scripts and the score and everything. And like, unlike us who have the luxury of, you know, a 6-month development process and then like a five months like... in the edit afterwards, like he'd have to go, right, hope this is mixed well. So let's all just do my script right now, please. And if we don't do it for half an hour, they're going to cut to the news. Go.
my favourite producer of all time was a guy called Charles Chilton, who produced the last radio drama in this country to get more listeners than TV had viewers, called Journey into Space back in the 50s.
Wow.
Great name.
It's very cool. Amazing voice as well.
Oh, yeah.
He's got a Cockney voice. First Cockney on the BBC in the 1930s. But I was lucky enough to meet him when he was in his 90s, sadly now, passed away. But he used to do this amazing sci-fi serial going out live with a full orchestra doing all the sort of huge stings and sound effects and everything.
God, live?
All going out live. And the best thing about it was, if that's not enough to contend with, you're talking about 50s BBC where everyone's just still pissing about and having a bit of fun. And there are stories about the cast.
Mostly smashed.
Probably mostly smashed. but these are wonderful actors. So you go, who'd you have? The actor's completely going to escape me now. But you had these incredible voices doing these things. Yeah. Very serious sounding actors. There's one story of one day them going down to the BBC canteen and getting some mustard and rubbing the mustard on the tip of the microphone. So when the character called Doc, who's doing this very Orson Welles type, we set out 6 months ago and with 20 men. Now we have 5. He's doing these really serious lines and just all the time going... and trying not to laugh. And there's another story where they just, at one point...
That's such a Beano prank.
Yeah, it is. The next one was better. One of them just during another... Like the ship's captain was very austere, called Jet Morgan.
Jet
obviously.
Morgan.
Obviously. At one stage, during one of his big serious moments where they just landed on the moon or something, he pulled his trousers back and just poured ice down his trousers.
That's so cruel.
So cruel. And this is going out live. There's no retake. It's just...
That's terrifying, isn't it? And I guess they didn't record them, or they did record them.
They went back and you can still hear them because they went back and recorded the first series for the American audience. So they all still exist and go out and listen.
Do they not do RRTs back then?
What's an RIT?
Recording of transmission.
There you go.
They didn't for the first series.
Your USS is defined by
So you did the live shows. You didn't like start the series and then do them. You did the whole series. You had it all in the bag, or all the podcasts, and then you went back and you pieced parts out. Is each episode one live performance and then you did it? Like, how do the live episodes work?
We aren't going to probably put out the live ones. I mean, the live ones sort of worked as we got whatever actors we could get back for it, which was mostly all of them. And of course our main cast. And then we basically went into the project files and got all of our sound effects out of it and played them in live when we just read the script out live.
It was actually quite nice because it was stressful, but we were making them as we went along. Like, we had this... And we have this grand plan that we'd have it all finished. But life happened. The problem is, we both have full-time jobs, and making a radio series is quite time-consuming.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And after a while, we just got a little bit behind. So it meant we were finishing the episodes...
on the Saturday?
We got them in for the Thursday broadcast. And then we had sort of 4 days.
Oh, yeah, of course.
They were every 2 weeks, but we had sort of 4 days. Then we would... turn over that episode into all the live sound effects and all the live cue-ins and adapt it for... Because David did an amazing job of, as I said originally, the scripts wouldn't work as you hear them in the podcast perfectly for a live audience. So David worked in new gags, worked in slightly new long-running jokes, and new sound effect gags. So we had to create a little bit extra. But then we just transferred this all across, and it actually, because we did it like that, it was in many ways such a relief having, we finished this episode, we hope it's good.
And then having an audience laugh at it.
And then an audience laughed at it. Yeah. And you go, oh.
That was really lovely.
Fab, yeah.
Because I guess that's one of the things you miss a bit, isn't it? That kind of real-time feedback of a good joke. You're like, oh, I'll put it out there. I hope people are laughing at it on the podcast.
It does make you sort of trust your comic instincts a lot after doing it for a while. Because, like, I mean, initially you're so sort of nervous about, like, oh, this is going to change how this joke delivery works if I move this clip like this and then put this sound effect in. But it's hilarious. Yeah. Like, I'm having a great time in my bedroom listening to it. I'm sure it's going to work.
Yeah.
And then you'd be testing your gags week for week. And so I think my edits do get better as the series go along because I'll get more confident with how the world interacts with people and things and make that work with the dialogue that's in there. Because you get to the live show, you see how a gag works in episode one, and then you go, right, I've got something similar in episode five, so I'm going to do...
So you did all the recording in 4 days, but then, and when did you finish recording? That was
and then
in,
we faffed
March.
About yeah. for like 2 months. And then
well, to be fair, so what
did you faff about for 2 months?
A little bit.
well, there's a what sort of happened?
I had a really good summer.
we put so much effort into getting it recorded. Yeah. We were meeting virtually every day with the production team and making sure we had.
And I hate all of them.
That's a lie. We've actually come out of this incredibly good friends, which is so good because we want to go and make more things. But the it was such a big process leading up to it. And seeing as it was basically January 1st, we sat down and went, we want to make this. From then on, most of our lives were spent emailing people, putting the thing together, making sure the script's good. And then there was this manic 4 days where we put our all... I don't think I've ever worked harder in my life on anything. And then we sort of went, let's take a step back for a bit. And then we had to put together episode one because we'd promised we'd premiere it at a radio festival in Copenhagen.
Oh, yeah, I remember you saying it.
So that was in August. So we had episode one out the door mid-August.
Yeah, yeah. A really, really good cut for episode one.
Really?
Which we change anyway?
Yeah, that was the thing. So we went out to Copenhagen. So I was out in Copenhagen for a week. I then, because I needed a break from the whole thing, I went off to the Edinburgh Festival for a week and had a wonderful week.
I had a nap.
You had a nap. I went and researched more comedy. But then we came back and with all our notes, because we'd had... essentially, what we did at Copenhagen was in this wonderful theatre called the Hussis Theatre, in the most hipster part of Copenhagen,
the meatpacking district.
Very, very weird. We're not cool enough to go and walk around there. It was very strange.
Speak for yourself.
and we ran there, and then we played it to an audience just as the draft, so not a live performance, just listening to it. And it was lovely because it was totally packed out, almost entirely with Danes or other radio professionals from across Europe.
Mm.
Germans, Icelandics.
Yes, lots of Scandinavian countries were there.
All English people.
And me. one to get a laugh from people whose first language it was, who wasn't English,
yeah.
was fantastic, because we felt we'd hit on something that wasn't just, oh, look at, we aren't we twee and doing this in our own country. It had an international appeal, which was wonderful.
I had a terrible fear about it, that we'd made something incredibly kitsch.
And it is, but in a good way, I think.
But it was nice. It was, yeah, it was vindicating.
But I'm going to make a terrible comparison here.
Oh,
but cool.
Here we go.
No, it's worth it, because it's a process that we just talked about, and it's a process that's been long defined in comic history. People like Stan Laurel, when they made their films, would then go and show them to a testing audience.
Oh, right.
And he'd sit at the back unbeknownst to the testing audience and sort of make a little note going, oh, God, they laughed so long there that they weren't ready for the next joke. Yeah. And when we listened to it in Copenhagen, we both came out of there, you know, having been pretty damn happy with what we sent off, going, oh, no, we understand now.
Yeah, yeah.
What the little
nuances. Do you mean the pacing of the jokes? I don't know, because I listen to... And the nice thing about your podcast is if you listen right to the end, on some of them there's like... On episode 5, there's like a little bit at the end where there's clips of the live thing.
And you
suddenly realise with a big audience, the laugh goes on and you can hear the guys kind of almost pacing themselves. They give it an extra couple of seconds before they do the next line because the laughter's so loud. And you realise when you're listening... I've not thought when you're listening to it, even there's... not laughter interrupting the noise, you're still trying to give it pace.
Yeah, enough space to appreciate what's going on.
Well, it is such a different listening experience doing a live show to a podcast, because, like, obviously, I don't know anyone that listens to podcasts with other people unless they're, like, in their car or something.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And so, you, like, normally, if you're listening to a comedy on your own, you won't really laugh that much.
Yeah.
And so the pacing has to be totally different.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you... don't want someone kind of like cackling on their own and then missing your plot.
Yeah.
And that's possible. Like, it,
and you start,
it happens.
And... Also, you start to appreciate where the really good gags are or where the really important character moments are.
Yeah, yeah. So you give them more space and... Carry on, I'll stop interrupting.
No, I didn't mean that. But again, because we had 4 days in here, we were incredibly lucky with our time, because we did do a read-through before we went in, which some radio dramas don't get the luxury of. None I've ever worked on, but I know professionally some don't. And so we would have a sense of it. We'd know exactly what we want.
Yeah.
But as with everything, after, you know, seeing it three times, you go, no, I really get that now. That's something why plays deep previews. So having that space to do that was really nice.
How, like,
this is a really long excuse for why we did it on the week.
No, I'm genuinely interested, because I was listening to Book of Mormon. I watched Book of Mormon, I suddenly imagined the read-throughs they must have had, reading through some of those jokes to an audience, to people who'd not heard it, and they're reading the script going, you can't say that, or that joke's, no. Were there jokes that people are like, do you think, no, or that's...
I can instantly point to two.
Yeah.
Most of which play on my favourite thing in the radio medium, which is silence. And there was one gag, I think it's in our first episode. Yeah, it is in the first episode, when Eric says to the mayor, because the mayor comes into Eric's funeral home, for those who don't know, convinced by Rudyard to shut it down quick.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yes,
can't have two funeral homes.
Yeah.
And Eric very suavely plays on the mayor's one weakness and says, well, one weakness, many weaknesses, but his main one. And turns around and says, you know what could have two funeral homes? A town. And then there's just silence.
A town, you say?
And we worked on this, and we both put in this much, you know, much longer gap than either of the actors have put in, because we thought it was hilarious.
As he's mulling over this idea of a town in a mile long.
Yeah, exactly. And we then sent it off to, because we, wonderfully, the production team also were proof listeners for us to spot some things that may have gone wrong or gone right. And pretty much all of them came back going, just this really dull pause in the middle of it. What are you doing? We thought, no, we're going to stick to our guns on this. We really like it. And then when we took it to Copenhagen, the audience were just, it was the first moment in the whole show where the whole audience just lost it.
Yeah, yeah.
And lost it for a long time. And I had people coming up to me after the show going, my favourite bit was that moment.
Really? That's amazing, isn't it?
I had random Danish people come up to me afterwards just going, a town, you say?
But I think it's also a gag that illustrates the most important thing about the radio medium, which is hinting at something and letting the audience's imagination, once you've given enough of a hint, letting the audience's imagination run wild. Mm. And when you've got a voice as dynamic, so characterful as Steve playing the mayor, the audience is left to wonder what that face is doing. And so the audience just is seeing this face sort of contort and think and drop. I mean, I don't know. It's their imagination. They've put their own thing on it. And
I mean, knowing how Steve's face moves.
Are you just making me think of all the bits that I like? Because I've never spoken to someone before who's like, essentially, you're like a film director, but you're not filming it. But the radio is such a brilliant medium. It's kind of like budgetless in the way that I was listening to a radio interview. I can't remember on which Guernsey or Jersey channel with David, and he was going, someone asked me, would the island have a marina? Well, it does now.
Yeah.
Is the island big enough to sustain a marina? It is now.
Why not? Yeah. It's such a brilliant thing to be able to do.
Just imagine things popping out of his imagination. Does the island have this? Sure, why not?
So my first big radio drama that I made. No, it's not quite. But the first one I really went overboard and started doing huge amounts of stuff.
Oh, we both have ridiculous ones for this.
So going back to the Zoom, it's very rich. We spoke about earlier. These lovely portable microphones. They are brilliant. You can, if you'd like, record a whole radio drama on one. And when I had no money and I had no experience, I was just learning. For some reason, I thought the easiest project to make would be a four-hour drama set in the English Civil War in an alternative history with a cast of 30 and a live orchestra.
Running before you can walk, but trying to fly a plane before you've even looked at a tricycle.
Which is my advice to anyone. Do that, because it teaches you everything you need to know by baptism of absolute fire.
You didn't do it, though, did you?
Oh, I did.
No,
it.
You did it. You can listen to it for free on the internet.
Oh, you can't. No.
It's in lockdown now, isn't
it? No, because it's a book that I got the rights to adapt from Random House.
The court case after the actor set you on fire.
So essentially it went out once and that was its lifespan, but it went on to win a couple of things, which was really lovely. But the thing I was going to say about that was, we went and stood in a field with a portable microphone and had battles with Oliver Cromwell charging up a hill as a slightly alien race stand at the top, machine gunning down, as airships swoop overhead, as mines go off, as the new model army march across. I have about 30 people on this project in total. In that scene, there's 10 people and 10 musicians. Yet, I stand by that scene and that piece of mixing.
It's pretty good.
It's you still, you know, no matter what the flaws in it.
I couldn't have made it as a teenager. Yeah. Mental.
Considering the flaws in it, you can still imagine this is going on. And that is so incredibly liberating, because to commit that to film, you would be looking at the biggest of Hollywood budgets.
Yeah.
Or going back to some sort of, you know, Waterloo era film budget where you've got thousands of extras and recruit the Soviet army. But we did it standing in a field with a microphone.
Nice, yeah.
It's the thing about radio that's really lovely, is like, rather than, you know, spending loads of money on it, you're just forced to be inventive. Like, because there's no way, like, if you went and recorded a battle scene, like, if you actually just, like, got on a plane, flew to Afghanistan, and then like drop yourself somewhere really horrible with a portable.
I would question your morals and your sense of.
Sure, but it'd sound weird. It wouldn't sound right. Like
just be you crying. This is all a mistake. Yeah.
The sobbing would get in the way of the violence. But like it wouldn't quite be right for what you were trying to get across. Like those big kind of cacophonous scenes have so much like liberation and planning into where everything has to go to make the mix work and to make it work with the dialogue and all that kind of stuff. You're forced into just trying to come up with a clever way of doing it rather than just, you know, throwing money at the problem. Like we had in my first project, it's my turn for another. It was me and my friend who I live with called Sam doing a project called The Nihilist Gardening Hour, which was about two guys going through space in an interstellar camper van Which again, like, immediately, so expensive to on film.
Why do we choose these projects?
But I love it. It's just limitless imagination. It said, do you know what? We're going to through space, cameraman, go.
Yeah. And so, like, in the first episode, we decided that they were going to literally fight bureaucracy. And so they land on this planet, which is like a planet of bureaucrats, and they get trapped by them, and they meet the system. And, like, so if you were doing that on Doctor Who, I imagine it would be a many-faced, slimy mass of, like, horrible, writhing goo that would be trying to absorb them at all times. That's sort of how we pitched it. And so trying to get that across in audio is daunting. And so what we ended up with was layering each of us doing the most grotesque high voice and grotesque low voice that we could do and trying to kind of pace match it to itself. So, like, I'd do a voice, this is going to sound horrible, where, just, where I'd be like, I am the system! And then underneath it going, I am the system. And then you layer it all over the top of each other, and then you have this horrible, it's still...
It sounds awesome.
One of the
still
most sounds disgusting great. Pieces of audio I've made. And... like, that is just a case of going, like, literally sat in the flat going, like, Sam, why have you written this thing? How are we going to do this? We ended up, like, getting through a whole bottle of squash, soothing our vocal cords, trying to do that one little bit of that scene. That is still available on the internet, amazingly.
What's it called?
The Nihilist Gardening Hour.
The Nihilist Gardening Hour.
To be honest, I haven't listened to it in a long time. I'm not sure I should be recommending it.
I love the idea of, like, people who live up and or below you in your flats going, the hell are they doing up there?
What earth is
going on? The system.
Oh, I did get complaints once. I was doing a I was asked to do the sound design for the Accrington Pals, which is a pretty good play set in the First World War. And most of the sounds in the first half were just sort of 19th century cities, early 20th century cityscapes and factory noises and things like that, which were really fun to do. And then we got to the Somme. And so I'm just sitting in my room with all these Somme sound effects going off and all these actors going, yeah, come on, lads, over your top, come on, yeah, whistles blowing. And someone just came around and went, what are you doing? We thought you were watching a war film, but it's been 4 days now.
Just all hours of the night. But again, going back to the imagination thing, I was talking to my parents and I said, they were like, have you seen the new Hobbit films? And I said, I think I've seen the original Hobbit film. There isn't one. But I realised as a kid, the story tape I'd listened to, in my head, I want to listen to it.
Oh,
I was like five
so
or six.
Lovely.
It was real, because I used to listen to it going to bed or whatever. And I suddenly realised, like, I listened to Roald Dahl story tapes in the car when you're a kid and stuff. And, like, all of that is, like, that's why I love this one so much, is because it's the first time I've really sat down and listened to, I guess, radio storytelling, but in a podcast format. And it just made me think, man, there must be hundreds of these that I could listen to now. I just, for some reason, in my head, things like that were like Radio 4 things my parents listened to. Now I'm like, oh, you guys are doing it. There's cool stuff on. And it's just a mindset thing. And I found the same when I started doing the podcast. Once I listened to 1, 2, 5, 10, now I just don't listen to radio. There's like, what do I want to listen to today? Like, and just, there's thousands of podcasts and they're really good, like really good. Because as you said, well, for me anyway, the intro to doing a podcast is the budget's so low, you know, for like £300 or £400, I've got everything I need. You get a pretty decent sounding quality podcast and you can publish it around the world for free.
Which is astonishing.
It's mental. Like, which I guess goes back to why you didn't go through the BBC. I just realised I'm crashing up to the hour mark and I haven't asked you anything about like series 2 or the BBC or anything.
We can cut a lot of what we've said.
No. We're not cutting any of it.
Cool.
No, it's all staying.
Nice.
The best ones, I did an hour and a half one with someone and it's one of the best ones. It was brilliant.
Oh, fair enough.
Random chat. That's what people like listening to. I try and do it so the first 20 minutes are us chatting about that half an hour and then the rest is just I want to find out more about, I don't know what it's like to be a producer and a director of a podcast and or radio and stuff, so no, it's all good, it all stays in. I interviewed someone yesterday and he was like, you're going to cut that out. I was like, no. He's like, please cut that out. I sound so stupid. I was like, I love that
whenever people do that, that's the tick, that's definitely staying.
And it was getting him more because he's so on it and controlled, and then he was like, no, please cut that out, and then it became funnier, like a running gag. But no, so why, let's go back to Overcoats, because I really should bring it back on point. Why didn't you go through... Why a podcast? There must be loads of different formats you could have done. Is it the freedom of just literally having no one above you going, has to be like this?
That's true. The other thing we didn't mention earlier that I really wanted to mention was the fact we did 8. And a BBC series is 6.
Or 4, most of the time.
Or 4 now. Quite a lot of 4s.
Why do they do that?
so they don't have to commit as much to sitcoms they might not want to put out all the episodes of, essentially.
Yeah.
It's not so much of a risk, there's lots of bits of logic to it,
but like it's also sort of less, it means they can get bigger names in because it's a smaller commitment for them. And there's like all sorts of like bits of BBC logic, but like
you definitely wanted to do 8 half an hour ones. You said half an hour because the format was the nice for a podcast, especially. Yeah. So it was rather 8 than 4 hour long ones.
Yeah, definitely.
I think what that 8 gave us though is because we got to. I mean, my favourite episode of the series has been from minute one, episode 6, because that's the moment. Just in terms of David's script. Because that's the moment where our characters have reached the point in sitcom where you'd normally go, oh, God, this is going to go on forever. Yeah, we're going to have to beat Chapman someday.
Yeah.
But they don't. Our characters look at each other as they try and bury a seagull.
Yeah.
And say, no, he's better than us.
Yeah.
It's not a case that this competition can go on with this setup forever. We're actually being really quite harmed by this whole situation. And you... It's the turning point. While you like the characters before, I think that's the moment where you actually go, no, I really care about these people. Mm. And it gives us a chance to turn the world on its head and to let it go somewhere unexpected, as opposed to having to then go, and there might be a series too.
Yeah, here's the setup. Every week, Chapman and Rodyard.
I don't want to give away for people who haven't listened to 7 and 8, but the whole situation changes for them. And the joy of having all those different writers as well meant that episode 7 has a very different style to an episode that David wrote, which Cordelia wrote.
7 was so much fun to make.
It just gives us that variety. And you have got that freedom, if not that we have the professional clout yet to go on the BBC, but you do have that freedom with a lot of respected producers. But you wouldn't have been given the time scale on which to work that out.
I mean, like, the whole sort of BBC thing, like, whether to go to them or not, they are basically your only option if you're doing radio comedy.
Yeah.
And so, like, doing it in podcast was sort of... Partly because, like, we are alarmingly young to be doing this, really, in terms of the industry. Like,
do you think so? Well, is that how you feel? Is that, like, that you are... Well, this is us. We're going out on a limb here. We're young. We're unproven. But you seem to have done tons of stuff before.
Yeah,
but...
yeah, students. We're just like weirdos who did it way too early. Like most people don't really get into this kind of stuff at all. Like
the podcast is probably changing that.
Podcast is I think podcast is really changing that. Yeah. But most comedy producers that you come across are people who might have done stand up or just have a real interest in scripts and that kind of thing. And so they're very firmly editorial.
Yeah.
Your industry people, when they go into an edit, tend to sit there in the golden throne, as they call it, while an engineer is doing all of that work for them, and they sit there and sort of go, oh yeah, could you do that? And do it that way, as opposed to what we do, where we're sort of hands-on with everything, and like our fingers are in every audio pie. Does that work?
USS, Andy, USS.
USS. USS Goddard. Oh God, where
but I do think, though, that the nice thing about that is that the series, I genuinely cared for the characters by the end, and maybe the advantage of having no one above you to tell you how to do things has given you the opportunity to maybe, I don't know, maybe there are points in the series where you're like, I don't really know where we're going with that, but the rest of it's great. But you didn't feel like you were exploring things, but it did feel like a really good, just single long story. And it's the first one I've really like, oh, I can't wait to listen to the next one.
Good,
like,
I'm glad.
Thanks.
That does mean a lot.
A lot of that comes from like, the clout of David. He's brilliant. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of our job really was to sort of make it work and tie it all together. I was going to name drop someone.
there it is.
when I took this script to people initially, I ended up talking to a friend of mine called Claire Broughton, who works in the production company, which will remain nameless and is now Googleable because I've mentioned it. I went, no animosity there. It was fine.
No, they gave us a huge amount of help.
Yeah, so. They're still kind of helping a little bit in a lot of ways. Where was I going with this?
You were name dropping Claire.
I was name dropping.
And so when we brought those scripts to her initially, she sort of read it and went, this belongs on Radio 4. And I was like, well, but that this year was crazy for it. There wasn't a spring commissioning round for comedy. and they got a new commissioner in for the autumn commission round, which meant that all the independent production companies had maybe two slots.
No,
so
nothing, isn't it?
Us coming in, young upstarts, going like, we really want to make this one Novacoat script. We'd have had to wait until October to pitch it. And the likelihood is the company wouldn't have pitched it for us because they've got all their own projects. They've got, like, you know, this year they made a Susan Kalman project, a Rob Newman project, really good, and like loads of other stuff with like these huge names, which is basically what the BBC care about.
And we thought we'd got a great team together, great team we'd liked, great team we've been with it since its inception.
Yeah,
and we didn't want to lose them, and we felt there was a danger that if we did go down that road, you know, understandably, to sell it, a broadcaster would go, yeah, we love it, but what if Rudyard was Benedict Cumberbatch?
Yeah.
You know, what more like Eric was Benedict Cumberbatch, but you know...
Yeah, definitely.
That'd be really good casting. I think we should have fired Tom.
I tried.
just kept on coming back.
I mean, Benedict was ringing me up every day.
Yeah, yeah. I had Martin Freeman calling me, going, give Benny the part.
I mean...
He's crying on my shoulder.
But he had to take Hamlet in the end, which...
Yeah.
Sucker move on his part.
Yeah.
But that's the... But don't you think, like, that's the great thing about podcasts, is that you're suddenly like, okay, well, all those other avenues have closed to us. Can we do it on our own? We can do it on our own. Yeah. Let's just do it on our own. Can we do it on our own? No, shit, we're going to do it on our own. Like, but you've done it. And it's like, that must be such a great feeling. And then to see the instant feedback, the downloads and stuff, you know, how many people are downloading?
The analytics are so addictive.
Yeah, I know. It's terrible. It's like Facebook likes. You're like, no, I'm not self-obsessed, but 1,000 more people have downloaded.
Yeah.
Felix is really into the analytics. The guy who plays Rudyard.
Love that guy.
And so we have a sort of group messenger thing. And every now and then he'll pop in and just go... Oh, Malta's joined the party.
By the way, guys, it turns out our ideal listener is in Canada, owns a Ford Mondeo, and listens to Eminem.
And works an admin. And probably has a kid.
Great. Thanks, Felix. We'll target our advertising at them in the future.
That's so amazing, isn't it?
Whoever you are who fits that exact description, thank you. Thank you for telling clearly all of your friends.
But that is, I just think that having a worldwide distribution network for free.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's
and like, how hard would you have had to work 10 years ago to get a guy in Canadian, a guy in Malta to listen to your podcast? You'd have been like, radio thing. It would have been impossible. That's the advantage the BBC has, is that like worldwide network. But now, it's great.
There's two sides to it, isn't there? There's if you're on Radio 4, you have an instant listenership because people have it on. You obviously have the money.
Money.
But in terms of just staying with the listenership for a second, I'm not getting into that sordid stuff. Someone will hear it on the radio
and pay you money.
By hearing it on the radio, you have listeners.
Yeah.
Whereas we are just casting it out.
Yeah.
With thousands and thousands, probably hundreds of thousands, of other podcasts across the world. And
what all the figure for that actually is?
I have no idea. I wonder if anyone is counting. iTunes must have some sort of record. But the
get your research on.
Yeah.
But then the plus side of that is, once someone has then searched you out and found you or clicked on a link for your podcast, they then have some sort of loyalty that they don't have because they happen to hear it as they were doing the washing up. And that's great. So it has its pluses and minuses, but I cannot believe that we have reviews from America, Canada, France, Spain. You know, and just thinking, this is extraordinary.
Yeah. It's about as close as you're going to get, unless you do it actually live, to a live performance. It's not laughs, but you get comments, and it's nice, and tweets and stuff. Like, that's amazing,
that's so
isn't
lovely.
It? Yeah, I mean, that must be such a nice thing to receive. Like,
it started really, you know, John basically doesn't use Twitter, so I have to tell him about all the nice things that come through.
I have Twitter if you want to follow me.
He has Twitter, but he won't say anything. His Twitter picture is amazing, actually. Is it still the panda?
It's still a lovely old BBC archive photo.
Old BBC archive photo of a panda with a microphone. It's amazing. But again, they're not used for anything. So, it's been the last few weeks, really, that, like, I think people must be sort of coming to the end of it. Obviously, we didn't really expect anyone to listen to it week for week because, you know, they're a fairly big commitment to sit down and listen to it, because they are sit down and listen properly to it as opposed to kitchen sink podcasts.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So I think a lot of people are now coming to the end of the series. And so I'll get a thing, you know, I've had about 20 vibrations in my pocket now. Probably a few of those are people going, I really like wooden overcoats. I'm going to recommend it to these people. And that's just such a nice feeling.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Something I haven't really come across before with any other project that I work on.
The other thing that was really nice, I saw a friend last week and we were chatting. She hadn't listened to any of them. And not have any, you know, things just hadn't got around to it. And she said, I'm going to start listening to them this week, meaning over the next few weeks I might get around to it.
Yeah.
4 days later, got a lovely tweet. Saying, I finished them all. That's so amazing. Well done. I'm like, well, that's great because it means, you know, you have been caught by it. You have caught the bug. And getting that feedback is so lovely. Seeing there's sort of a community developing online.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Which is really lovely. Like fan fiction is appearing. And which is just charming to see.
But it's really good.
To see.
We've got talented fans.
They've captured the essence. Yeah. But to see, what was the name of the character? September Edgewood?
Yeah, September Edgewood.
Someone had written a character called September Edgewood, and I thought,
I really wish
they'd
call
them. I could believe that was a character that was in the show.
I really wish they'd call them Edgeware, and it was Dr. Edgeware's brother. I really love
this idea that you've got this imaginary island. You've now got imaginary extra people living on this imaginary
just
island.
Yeah.
And they started naming the roads. Like, we didn't name the roads.
That was one of my favourite jokes is where, when does Antigone try and leave? Right, I'm going to get on a bus and leave. And they're like, we don't have a bus. The island's only a mile long, but we don't have a bus.
What did you think? But I love that that's a bit of logic out of no logic anywhere else.
Yeah, she's never seen a bus or used a bus, but she's adamant there must be a bus on the island.
You'll notice this. Only one car in the whole series. There's a car and a moped, and those are.
When did the car appear?
The car belongs to Seymour Profit.
Of course it does. Yeah.
He has the Lamborghini for some reason. How has it got there?
that was a really bad. That was a really good decision. I like the atmosphere, but very quickly we realised. We said,
oh
no,
my god, we couldn't use anything.
Yeah, there are no cars on Piffling because it's a tiny island. We thought it was a bit like Sark in that, you know, there are horse and carriages and nothing more. Yeah. Although you very rarely hear anything like that.
Well, apparently Alderley, where, like, there are cars, there's only about five, because there's absolutely no point.
Really? Lives don't drive.
Yeah. So we've had people from the Channel Islands tweet us going, like, we love this detail because it's, like, just like our hometown. David the writer hasn't even been there. So we had our flatmate, basically, as our Channel Islander consultant.
You need a Channel Islander consultant. Is this all right to say?
Yeah, no, it's too close to home. Well, you shouldn't, but yeah.
Will this be considered racist? Is it? It's just, oh, God. But what it meant
that we decided that there were no cars was every sound effect. We record a lot of sound effects ourselves, but also everyone we went to find in Creative Commons sort of stuff to pull in.
There's a plane.
There's a car. There's a plane.
There's a motorbike.
Yeah, you can't have those things because, not that we ever say it.
Yeah.
But if you suddenly heard, I think if you heard a car going past on any of the episodes, you'd go, huh?
What's that?
Yeah.
What's that?
What's that doing?
And so when Georgie brings a moped up and has found it somewhere and restored it, you think, yeah, of course she has. And when a man turns up in a random Lamborghini and, Rudyard, how are you doing? Yeah, of course he does. It's part of his character, but he probably had it choppered in, you know, it's...
He must have.
He must have had it choppered.
I love the idea of Georgie just standing there looking up at that helicopter as it comes in with a Lamborghini dangling right.
What the hell is that?
Oh, I love helicopters.
I don't think there's a harbour geared up for loading cars in. I don't think there is.
There's the yacht marina.
But that's a yacht marina.
There's a yacht marina.
How would it'd have to drive along the jetty. That's a nightmare.
Onto a yacht.
I'm waiting for some fan fiction where someone draws the island and the one road and the one jetty and like they just start drawing this like tiny little island. It's like a little SimCity project.
We have
actually on
there's a map.
On the Lamborghini note, wonderful guest cast member Max Aleska, part of the comedy duo Max and Ivan. Who did an amazing show in Edinburgh this year, set in a tiny promontory on the south coast. And as part of their publicity, they gave out a map of the island.
No way.
And just had a sort of gap that said, not quite sure, couldn't be bothered to put stuff in here, but it doesn't really make sense anyway, so don't worry, or something. It was a better joke than that, but it was just lovely. And you thought, yeah, you've got the same feel of create your own island, make this image. And again, just leaving it to the audience to somehow try and picture the whole thing together.
I love how you, because you don't describe everything, you just imagine any town that you've been to that has that kind of quiet, bizarre, backwards personality, that's the environment that it is, right? And that's the great thing about radio. You're not hyper-describing everything. You're just letting the imagination go, yeah, I've been to a place like that. I guess that's why those like other countries that have those random places that they get
will have
it.
Their small villages. Yeah.
I always think that's a mark of a really good radio writer, someone who has the confidence to let the audience fill in those gaps themselves. Because imagine if, you know, you had Rudyard walking back into Fun Funerals and going like, oh golly, the red awning on this funeral parlour looks rather spiffing in the sunlight today. However, it's obstructing my view of the door, which is made of oak.
But there is, come to think of it, there is absolutely no description of Fun Funerals at all in the whole series. There's a description of the business and where it came from.
Dusty, woody.
It possibly says something like that.
We have a Madeline intro for it. Oh god!
But there's
such an anorak for this.
But there's not much. There's nothing that lays out.
I love
the counter.
Yeah, I love the conversation vehicle that is Madeline. She's like the narrator. Yeah. When I first heard it, I was like, oh, it's a narrator. And then the second Belinda. I heard the, I was like, that's brilliant, because she can just be wherever the narrator needs to be. Yeah. It's like a great vehicle to kind of. But such a lovely idea that why not? They should have a mouse in it.
And Belinda Lang, like, geez.
She was superb.
That's a lovely production story as well, actually. So we recorded all of her bits separately to the main event the week after, I think I want to say, like the Monday after.
Yeah, it was straight after.
Like, still, like, you know, knackered from the week before. But she came and met us after work on the Monday at his studio at the RNIB, and we did all of those Madeline things in about 3 hours.
Mm.
Downstairs, no, and like, she was just good enough to give an afternoon of her time before she went off and carried on touring Oklahoma.
How amazing is that?
But that was the thing with all our cast, really, wasn't it? Andy Hamilton coming in and like, oh, Andy, thank you so much for coming in and doing this. What are you up to for the rest of the day? Well, I'm writing this film script with this really famous author, and I'm doing this. He says, hoping that things aren't embargoed, and just and you just go, well, thank you for coming here, and just being with us, and you know. And Paul Putner and people like that. And you think, wow, this is extraordinary.
Getting Andy was fun as well, because he worked in my office.
Rudyard. Is that who you mean?
No, Andy Hamilton.
Oh, okay.
So I worked in the production company, which remain nameless. I don't know why I'm sticking to
it. I don't know why.
It's Patrick.
Everyone knows that Andy Hamilton works for Patrick. Yeah, it's pretty
Patrick.
Much it.
Patrick, they were nice to us. It's great. I think I did it to save embarrassment. Whatever. Right. So he has an office in Hattrick, not paid by them, but he just writes so much for Hattrick that they've ended up just being like, just have a glass room, just take it. And I basically just really wanted him to be in it, just because it would, just Andy Hamilton, it's amazing, like radio comedy legend.
Yeah.
If you go back over like his old work, like Old Harry's Game is one of the funniest bit of radio sitcom ever. It's fantastic.
Outnumbered pioneer the improvised sitcom for the modern age.
Yeah.
You wrote Outnumbered. What a guy.
Yeah. Him and Guy Jenkin did Drop the Dead Donkey as well.
Oh my god, absolute legend.
I mean, this man is behind some of the most important comedy in this country in the last 30 years, probably.
Yeah, and most people's view of him is that he just sort of saunters onto QI and like just sort of, like,
he's very
just witticisms and then leaves. Mm. But like, no, just a rich history of amazing comedy.
And it was so lovely as well, because we got him to play slightly off character.
Yeah.
And he was such a wonderful perfectionist as well. He came in and...
Sorry, who did he play again?
He plays Herbert Cough, the projectionist.
Oh, yeah.
And so his most famous character is him being on the radio. Well, both his famous characters really are probably McGurk from Revolting People, which is a sitcom set in War of Independence in America. And the other one is the devil in Old Harry's Game. But in both, he plays sort of likeable rogues.
Mm.
Whereas here, he slightly steps over the line into a little bit menacing. He's lovely.
Yeah.
But you're not quite sure of him. And I thought that was lovely. I thought you still really cared about him, and you went, "Oh, it's Andy Hamilton, and he's playing this amazing character." But there was something you went. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the character brief I gave him for it was unsettlingly lonely, and I think he ran with that so hard by the end of it, like, because I don't want to do spoilers, but there's a bit where he gets a bit creepy.
Yeah.
It's not that creepy. It's still a light, lovely program.
It's still lovely.
But it's humorously creepy.
Yeah. But like, it's just one line at the end of the episode where like we wanted to give the impression of like basically the show is about everything going wrong for our main three characters all the time, right? And so this is And so him being a bit creepy would make it go a bit wrong for one of their characters, because he's sort of a refuge for them. And so in this sort of one line, he did it about sort of three or four times. And each time he just went, no, I couldn't do creepy.
The way you're saying it's creepy.
But my favourite... my favourite thing about all the characters and everything they're saying that's creepiness, and it was my sort of big directing thing coming into it, was while all these people are adults and they're living in this very grown-up community that deals with some quite big issues, they are children in a playground who haven't quite worked out what social interaction is yet. So you've got the lonely kids in the corner, and you've got the mayor, who's sort of the king of the playground but doesn't really know why, and you've got the clever kid who's behind the mayor helping out, and all these things I always saw as very much piffling is this playground. But the one thing that leads on to is, you know, they're gonna go somewhere, because you know this naivety is wonderful and charming, but you know it's got to develop into some sort of complex situation as they grow up, essentially. And so throughout the series, you have love interest developing, you have politics between the characters and the businesses developing, and those real family squabbles. And it was such a delight to go from lovely, charming, childlike, but very, very clever humour into something perhaps a tiny bit more. And Andy's probably the first hint that it's going to go that way.
It might go a bit dark.
So, I think I've taken up so much of your time, but I do feel like I could carry on talking to you for ages. We'll wrap it up now, but my last question is, you've built up all this momentum and all these episodes. When series two? Or are you going to do a series two? Or?
We announced this the other day.
We did just announced series two. Okay. Well, as a we really like want to make it.
Yeah, we really want to make series two.
I really want you to make series two. Too.
I'd really want to make series two. Essentially, though...
Philip Buck coming in.
It's a problem of means. So the...
I love the person.
This is going to sound like realistic.
I'm going to talk about money. Don't worry, it's not talking about. It's a problem of means.
It's a problem of means. And recapturing our USS. But like, essentially, we did the first series off a lot of like lovely people giving their time for free and whatever, and like a lot of favors, a lot of goodwill, and so. Almost don't want to be sort of cheeky and ask the same thing again for no money and all that stuff. So for series two, what we're really trying to do is try and find a way to, you know, compensate people for their time a bit more. But podcasting, not the most lucrative industry.
I'm aware of this,
So we're basically just trying to find a way to do it.
However, it's gonna happen.
It's gonna happen.
Yeah. Have you thought of like crowdsourcing or Kickstarter or anything like that?
We are probably going to do some kind of thing like that. I have been embargoed from saying exactly what by Felix.
things are around the corner, I think is the best way of saying
things are around the corner.
And hopefully there will be a little, even before series two, we'll have a little bit more, a few tidbits.
We got some treats.
That we have planned and people have signed up for. So,
But also we've got other sitcoms. Like
we've both got tons of other stuff going on as well.
So like we've got a lot.
But I only want to know about Wooden Overcoat,
which is fair.
We've got the others
don't exist yet. So
we've got a lot of stuff on the Audio Scribble development slate that we can do quickly and will be doing quickly, sort of in the new year, while we're in line, kind of developing the second series of Wooden Overcoat. Because I think we're going to be sort of launching into it quite quickly anyway.
Yeah.
And doing all of the prep for it, and then it'll be a case of when it comes to production, whether we have the money or not. You know. That'll be amazing, comes down to it.
So do you have any sort of day, or are you trying to like summer?
I wish we had a date.
We haven't even had that meeting yet, to be honest.
We had the meeting before we even sat in studio to record one.
I want to do another.
because we got so many good writers involved, they'd all gone, oh, but we've got these other ideas, and David had to rein them back.
Yeah.
Because, well, there are only 8 episodes.
Yeah.
So we
only,
yes. But we knew from that point that there was enough that we loved about all the characters to say, no, we definitely want to do more. And then the reaction has been so wonderful. I mean, the fact the Telegraph came back and said, what was the really significant moment in radio comedy? Quietly significant moment in radio comedy.
Yeah, that was an amazing quote to have, right? Yeah, I mean, that's just a seismic shift in how like podcasts are promoted, or just how great radio. doesn't need to be on a radio anymore. Yeah, so the whole industry is kind of shifting.
And for someone to feel that we did that for a genre,
yeah,
is such a privilege.
I mean, is it true? I don't know.
100%.
I'm happy to allow.
I'm starting to listen to them, so you know, there you go. I'm not your entire seismic shift.
But thank you.
You're at least a plate.
But I think having seen the reaction it's got, we all know that we definitely want to do more.
Yeah.
And every time I see anyone, even on all my other sitcoms, they all go, so you're doing more Overcoats, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of actors also going, so you're doing more Overcoats, right? but we wouldn't let it go.
I shouldn't commit this to tape, but I'm going to. I had a game earlier, like basically just after the Telegraph thing,
yeah,
where I started gaining followers on Twitter all of a sudden, which is very unusual
for
me.
You're like, unpopular, unpopular.
And then I sort of noticed two trends. And so it became a game whenever the thing came up I'd go, like, I'd read the name out to my housemates, and I'd go, actor or Tory?
Over to Telegram.
It would invariably be an actor who was like, they follow you because they want to work with you. Yeah, fair enough. Like,
yeah.
No, if I was the
everyone
actor,
does it. Yeah.
It's people from the Telegraph who are openly like, avid Telegraph reader, like David Cameron is my homeboy, like all this kind of stuff. And it's just like, are you real?
We're so pleased to have all your Telegraph readers on board.
No, I love it. But it was just a particular kind of Telegraph reader that was following me was just like openly very, very conservative.
You can see where these things have come from.
And so it was just so funny that I was getting followed by no one else.
Yeah.
Like, it was, actors or like political activists.
Right? But it's amazing. I guess it's weird to see your audience, you know, like.
Mm. Yeah.
Wow, that's like at a live show, that would be like polling everyone that came exactly what they did and finding like an unusual amount about each one. You just see on their Twitter feed, you can see what they talk about, what they look like. It's like
we don't do that because that would be a little bit weird.
I am speaking
for myself. However, no, I was very surprised recently. I messaged the group because I was told by a friend of mine who's an actor that his friend had gone along to one of our live shows who knew none of us.
Mm.
And had just come because he was a fan of the show, and he was like, "Oh yeah, he's a pretty good actor. You should meet him. He was in The Detectorists." And go, "Oh wow!" So that's another, you know, something else we all really respect and really think is a really great piece of comedy writing at the moment.
If you haven't seen it, catch up on it. I mean, I'm a series.
What's it called again?
Online.
Sorry,
The Detectorists.
The Detectorists.
The Detectorists.
Written by Mackenzie Crook, who's the in Pirates of the Caribbean, is the one with the comedy glass eye.
Yeah,
that guy.
And The Office.
And The Office, of course. Yeah. Oh yeah, that's a. Much more in canon reference. Yeah, yeah. He's in The Office. He's brilliant.
Never seen The Office.
What? Who hasn't seen The Office?
You're stripped of your producer.
Turn this microphone off. I did think about... I'm going off a bit of a tangent. The thing I love about The Office is me and my friend were talking. I can't think of anything more boring than the jobs that they've assigned those guys. Like a paper mill in Swindon. Mm. Like any other job, like the worst type of job. It's at least interesting because it's so bad, but this is literally the most boring thing you can think of.
Super bland, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then when you mentioned Piffling and this idea of an island, I was like, it's not boring. It's just like you've just created something that you think is just like it should work, but I don't understand how these islands have survived in like a little insular environment.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
how are they not hundreds of years less evolved than the rest of the
world? And
telly,
is...
I guess, must be the only way that they just police themselves.
With any setup, though, it is how do you make that island plausible, or that place plausible? Because
like, how do they get any money? Like, yeah, how do they earn any wages or anything?
And often it is that balancing act between. It's a lie. I've seen bits of The Office. I've just never watched it consistently. But it's a balance between those ridiculous characters that you think, oh, they can't exist.
Yeah,
they'd be fired years ago. Yeah. How has this guy risen to the point of boss? But if you love them enough and you're invested in those stories and those characters enough, that you just go, yeah.
Well, yeah.
I also think to an extent The Office works because everybody's had a boss like David Brent.
Yeah.
Like, they have.
I've been fortunate enough.
Yeah. They exist. They're real people and they're terrifying.
I worked at my old office and I almost couldn't watch The Office because it was too cringeworthy because all those horrible moments of like, oh, he gets his guitar out, kind of felt a bit like I'd had at work.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But then... I'm going to go back to Roger because I literally am. I love the guy, but I do feel like everyone knows
so happy.
Knows someone a little bit like Roger who's just lovely but ridiculously stubborn at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah,
just a little bit like my best mate who's actually going to produce the photos and put this on Acast. But he's like you're like Roger, Dave, you should listen to the podcast. Right, well, I think I'm going to wrap that. We've gone well past the hour mark, and you guys have given me all your time and amazing studio setup. So thank you so much. Well, it's been really good, and I look forward to season two, series two, when it comes out in the summer, maybe this year.
We'll be in touch to plug our other sitcoms.
100%, and I'll be there. So thank you so much. That was brilliant.
Thank you.
Right,
thank you.
I have no idea how to operate that machine.
Then you have the lovely bit of audio.
There you go. That was episode 12 of the Create More podcast with the wooden overcoats. I hope you enjoyed that. I think if you're still listening to this part, I love this part. I'm just going to waffle on. No, I have a serious thing to say. So one major person I didn't mention at the beginning as a little teaser is the next podcast is going to be with Fred Mills from the B1M, you know, inside the architectural profession. BIM is a massive talking topic, and if you don't know what that is or don't care about architecture, you know, maybe that's not the podcast for you. But if you do, it's a really, really good one. Fred Mills, he started his own website called the B1M, and they aim to get a million views about not like what software to use, but like why building information modeling, why it's the future of architecture. It's a really, really interesting subject matter, and man, he's passionate, but he's also like incredibly articulate in his answers. So it's a really, really fun podcast. I've already recorded it, and it's a really good one. So I'm really glad I've already got that one all saved up and ready to go. So unbelievably, I'm just going to stop talking now and say thank you for listening. Tune in a couple of weeks' time to listen to the Fred Mills one, and subscribe and share it to your friends, and email me at ben.stewart@createmore.com. Sorry, createmorepodcast.com. So that's our new website. Here you go, here's a little secret. If you're listening to this, I've paid up to for a year for a website. What I'm trying to do is over this series is build up this kind of visual website of like all the podcasts and all the images and things. And PageCloud is the kind of website builder that I've signed up to. And if you've used these website builders before, I use Squarespace, and it's fine, but I didn't really get on with it. But PageCloud, it allows you to like drag and drop images from Photoshop. So you kind of do everything in Photoshop and just drag it across. I mean, I say it's simple, I just haven't had time to do it. But I've bought, you know, createmorepodcast.com. So this is my big plan. And I'm curious, genuinely tweet me. This is the first of the new series of the series two, but I'm still calling it episode 12 confusingly, but I'm not putting the images on Acast. I put a huge amount of effort into series one to put images on. And what happened was, I found out that actually 95% of the people that listen to it through iTunes, which obviously doesn't get the embedded images I do in Acast. And then actually inside of Acast, I found out hardly anyone was even clicking on the images, and people who were even using Acast were like, oh yeah, I didn't realize I had images. So I'd spent, you know, hours getting these images in and, you know, making sure they were like just the right image. And I was really proud of them, but, you know, I want to spend as much time as possible creating content, and, you know, that takes away from doing more actual audio podcasts. So if in any way you've realized I've not done them, I'm genuinely curious, because from like my little market bit of analysis, no one actually kind of, well, not many people, I'm sure some people do, but, and I'll be honest, I listen to the Scroobius Pit one all the time, which is one of the few ones I know that does put images in, and I almost never click on the images. But I thought with architecture and a visual medium, would it work? I don't know. But tweet me if it has. It's Create More PCast, and I'm Ben Stewart. So thank you so much for listening, and I'm really excited about this series. So thank you. Bye bye.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.